Okay, so today I want, or my plan is at least, we'll see how it goes, to talk about acceleration and also the cosmological constant, otherwise known as lambda. David tells me you've done a homework on Rindler space, so hopefully the beginning bit will be sort of fairly familiar to you. But I still think it's worth kind of redoing, because what we've seen when we looked at black holes from a sort of causal perspective, we saw the event horizon. There was one event horizon which shielded the singularity of the black hole. So that, you know, there was this sense in which a horizon, you know, shielded something quite dramatic. Whereas with acceleration, it introduces us to a different sort of horizon. Rather than a horizon that's sort of inward, something small that we can kind of go around, it's a horizon that's something big and sort of away from us, what we might call a cosmological horizon. And then that will lead quite naturally to thinking about lambda, the cosmological constant with cosmological horizons. And I want to talk a little bit about thermodynamics when we've got a lambda. So the purpose of this week is to try and cover more sort of advanced formal topics, and also trying to sort of make contact occasionally with the literature, so sort of current research topics. So that's the idea of this week. So we can write down the world line of a uniformly accelerating observer. It's going to be obviously not a straight line in our flat space-time, because we want to have a non-zero x double dot. Somehow we want x double dot to be some constant. And here, the way I've written this down, if I look at my velocity, for velocity of my observer, you see that it has a length 1. So that tells me that the tau parameter that I've got there is a proper time parameter. And if I look at my acceleration, x double dot, just parametrically, x double dot is a squared times x. So this is telling us that we've got a constant acceleration. And tau is the proper time of our observer. So if I sketch what's going on from the perspective of Minkowski spacetime, this is the picture I've got. So from the perspective of a static inertial observer in Minkowski spacetime, this particle is undergoing acceleration, which means that its velocity is going to keep going up and keep creeping up, but it can never be faster than the speed of light. So we get this hyperboloid that is asymptoting. It's sort of always going towards the speed of light, but never quite getting there, because of course it's a time-like observer. So these would be my null coordinates, you know, from if we were thinking about sort of the picture of a black hole horizon when we defined our capital U, capital V Kruskals. So a different way of sketching this would be to compactify. So we had our Minkowski space-time, our Penrose diagram. And this would be our sort of sketch of our accelerating observer. So they never quite reach the speed of light, but they're asymptoting it. So our observer actually starts at some point on scry minus and ends up at some point on scry plus. So if I think about what the just what's going on causally, we can see that this observer can never see this part of the space-time, and they can never influence that part of the space-time. So we've got these causal boundaries in the space-time for that observer. There's no fundamental causal boundary within the space-time, it's just because the observer's accelerating. So we change coordinates to something based on the observer's world line. So we rewrite our Minkowski T and X in terms of rho and tau. And we get something that's actually familiar, even if you hadn't met it before through Rindler, because that is pretty much the space-time that we got for the domain wall. We had this factor, although there were more coordinates there. So there we had 1 minus z over L squared, and that was a something like this, I think. So that was why I was so quick to draw the domain wall as being a hyperboloid, something that was like a hyperboloid in a flat space-time. It's the same principle here, where we have an accelerating observer that's moving along a hyperboloid. So these tau and rho coordinates cover 1/4 of the space-time. So we've got basically, this is where they cover. And this is called Rindler space-time. So that was what you saw in the homework. Or the Rindler wedge. Because it's like a wedge out of space-time. So that is the space-time of an accelerating observer. And it's flat. quite dried off, this one. So the accelerating observer has horizons. It has a future horizon here and a past horizon. So the horizons occur at that row coordinate being 1 over A. So just like the black hole, the black hole horizon is at R equals 2gm, but when we draw the causal structure of the black hole, we kind of see that there's a future horizon and a past horizon. Our accelerating observer also has a future acceleration horizon and a past acceleration horizon. So the accelerating space-time kind of emphasizes that horizons are distinct from singularities. So here, our horizons are just a feature of our accelerating observer. They are purely a causal statement. They're a statement about causal structure of the space-time and nothing to do with a sort of physical singularity. So although we often think of an event horizon as being a black hole, in fact, the horizon is simply some sort of causal boundary for some reason in our space-time. So here, we've come to these future and past horizons via starting from the flat space-time, whereas when we did the domain wall, we started with the wall and went to seeing that it was just a causal horizon. And I think that was something that was sort of by going in the opposite direction, I think it was perhaps just a little more difficult to absorb. But if we thought, well, what if we were given this space-time? How would we have identified these were just causal horizons? How would we have done a Kruskal extension? I'll just sort of well, we would follow the same procedure as for the black hole. We'd define a tortoise coordinate. And then we'd define our u and v coordinates. As exponentials of, maybe that's not very visible there, exponentials of Eddington-Finkelstein-like coordinates. So if we constructed Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates in the same way as we did with the black hole, we start off by defining a new radial coordinate so that we can easily write down null coordinates as t plus or minus r star. So here it's tau plus or minus rho star. And then we exponentiate to get our cruscals. And then if I look at, you know, u is going to be the exponent of tau minus rho star, I look at what that is. Here I get my factor of 1 minus a rho, which you see coming in the definition of both t and x. And then this e to the minus a tau is simply the difference between a sinh and a cosh. So that's sort of how we get, we would have just immediately written down our null coordinates as t plus or minus x when we started with Minkowski spacetime. But if you start from the accelerating observer's perspective, you can follow through all the steps to get back to the Minkowski space. So that's really just showing, you know, what kind of finishing the packaging of how, when we did the domain wall, we could see how to continue across that apparent horizon at z equaled l. So before I move on, are there any questions on Rindler? Or do you feel happy because you had a homework on it, so you think, I know this stuff? Yep. Okay. So remember when we were doing the spherically symmetric metric, we had an expression in the area gauge for the radial component of the metric. So that was that 1 over grr was basically had an integral that looked like m of r. So at the time, we were thinking about black holes and vacuum solutions. So we just had a T naught naught being some sort of weak field matter source to give us the interpretation of the M in the Schwarzschild solution as a mass. Instead, what I want to do now is to think about what would happen if we had a cosmological constant. So the cosmological constant was a term that Einstein introduced when he was developing his theory of relativity. And notoriously, he kind of introduced it to get a static universe. Because in 1915, although there was already observational evidence coming in suggesting that the universe was not static, I think the general the general consensus was that that we had fixed heavens around us. So a theory that was already pushing it in terms of being very mathematical and using this, which again was not really common, having all this extremely fancy mathematics telling you about some physical theory. If that then told you the universe was expanding, it would probably mean that, you'd just get, yes, of course, very good, go off, disappear. So he wanted to make sure that he had a static cosmology. So that was why he introduced this lambda. And of course, rather embarrassingly, within about a year, de Sitter had shown that this constant solution actually gave rise to an exponentially expanding universe, which was a bit not the point. So famously called it, or paraphrasing his biggest blunder. That's sort of the classic way of thinking about lambda. But what is lambda? Lambda is a, we can think of it as an effective energy momentum source. So this would be our effective energy momentum. And because we have conservation of energy momentum and our metric is covariantly conserved, we deduce that this lambda is in fact a constant, hence the name, cosmological constant. So it's a completely uniform energy momentum source. It has a pressure. That was a good yawn somewhere behind me. Its pressure, we think of it in terms of a fluid interpretation. Its pressure is negative, so we have a tension that is equal in magnitude to the energy density with C equals 1. So this is a very extreme energy momentum tensor. We have a negative pressure that is highly relativistic. It's the same magnitude as the energy density. So this is fairly major thing. Question?
Negative pressure means like
it's actually a pulling. So if you think of a pressure is kind of pushing outwards. So a tension is kind of a pull. Yeah. So everything, all of the, you know, we've got an isotropic sort of stress tensor or whatever that's constantly pulling. And that's bizarre. You know, it is definitely strange. We can think of it intuitively, or at least build up some intuition about it, if we think about strings on a violin, because those are under tension, they're being pulled apart. So it's that sort of notion of something pulling, but then you have to take it to its complete extreme, where the pulling is the same magnitude as the energy density. So that is just weird, you know, from a sort of everyday physical perspective.
Mm-hmm. So, wait, negative, negative pressure means that the universe is getting...
Well, it actually means exactly the opposite. So pressure is more like a glue. So in Einstein's equations, because we have to have something that is completely covariant, we see that not just energy gravitates, but also pressure and strain and stresses. And the pressure is actually giving you a positive gravitational effect. So pressure you can think of as like a glue. Even though I agree it's counterintuitive, because you think of pressure, well, I've got a box of air and the molecules are bouncing off the walls, so they're pushing outwards, yeah? So surely that means it's pushing space apart. But in fact, not. That's how we think of it, but not according to the geometry. The geometrical effect of pressure, particularly in the cosmological arena, as you'll see in the cosmology course, is actually to glue, it's a positive contribution to the Einstein equations. So in the Einstein equations, when you get to thinking about cosmology, you'll find this combination of rho plus 3p. And this is known as a strong energy condition. So when you look at what gravity does, what geometry does to geodesics, if this combination is positive, gravity is attractive. So gravity is only is not always attractive. This is, so if this is greater than zero, gravity is attractive. So in other words, geodesics converge. That's our feeling of gravity being attractive. It's sucking things in. So although I totally don't agree, you know, with what you just said in terms of our physical understanding of pressure is thinking it pushes out, its impact on the geometry is actually to be is the same sign as energy density. It's drawing things in, whereas tension is pushing things away. Now, for the domain wall, we had a tension on the wall in two directions. So in fact, rho plus 3p for the domain wall is negative. And that's why we see the domain wall accelerating outwards. If we were a static observer here, sitting at t equals zero, we could say the observer's accelerating away from us. Physically, we know that to be the case because we can see it from the perspective of x double dot. But from the perspective of the wall, you know, whether we are accelerating away from the wall. And so it's as if this is how we kind of think of that. Gravity is repulsive in that, in the sense that we are moving away from the gravitating object. So I agree, it seems backwards, but that's the way it is. So, yep. Mm-hmm.
So did Einstein add this to get this piece, or?
So that when you do cosmology, you'll see that there is an exact sort of static solution of a closed universe, so where our three spatial dimensions are just like a sphere, where the lambda, so I guess sort of, the universe would be wanting to shrink in, but the lambda kind of supports the sphere. It's actually an unstable solution, but of course Einstein didn't know that when he wrote it down. So it's called the Einstein static universe. And it was it was just that what he found, you know, he was sort of wanting to sort of see what this theory of gravity meant for cosmology. And he found if he put in this lambda, he could get a static solution. So, I mean, cosmology wasn't taken all that seriously, you know, till about 50 odd years ago, although people still did it. But nonetheless, you know, there was an awareness that you had to be able to, people wanted to start trying to describe the universe around them during, you know, the early part of last century. And so, you know, if you're coming up with a brand new theory, you don't want it to just look utterly wrong before you start. So, yeah, I think it was reasonable. And then, of course, the irony is that now with cosmology, we do believe there is indeed a small lambda. So we are actually in an accelerating universe. So if I put this energy momentum tensor into this expression here for GRR, then I can sort of pull in that 2g inside the integral, and then I've got 8 pi g t naught naught, which is lambda. So I get this integral here, which gives me an actual, as well as my integration constant, I get a term proportional to lambda. So my potential, if you like, this is also equal to gtt. My gravitational potential doesn't just have this Newtonian term of 2mnr. It's also got this cosmological constant term. So now you see why I was talking about acceleration horizons, because if lambda is positive, which is what we're usually dealing with in cosmology, If lambda is positive, we get another horizon. So we have something like the acceleration horizon. So if lambda's positive, it's what we call a de Sitter spacetime because de Sitter found the solutions with a pure lambda. And if M is non-zero, then we call it Schwarzschild de Sitter. But we have a horizon even in de Sitter space. So I could call this, say, L. And this is very much like the acceleration horizon. It's a causal boundary, but it's nothing to do with a singularity. And it's called a cosmological horizon. Because, as you'll see, it corresponds to a sort of boundary in a cosmological interpretation of de Sitter space. So in cosmology, we sort of see that we have an expanding universe, galaxies are receding from us. If we have a lambda, our universe is exponentially expanding. And so what that means is the further things are away from you, the faster they're receding. And if we have exponential expansion, we have this limit where the recession velocity is the speed of light. So that's like the causal horizon. So we call this a cosmological horizon. And our de Sitter spacetime, which we usually abbreviate as DS, is a constant curvature spacetime. So it's maximally symmetric. It's the Lorentzian equivalent of a sphere. So it's constant curvature. And one of the features is of these maximally symmetric spacetimes is you can often find a lot of different ways of writing coordinates that are natural and useful. So I'll just write down some of those. So the one that we've just found is what we call a static coordinate system, because in this representation of de Sitter space, d by dt is a Killing vector. There's also what we call a global coordinate system. In this coordinate system, the whole of de Sitter spacetime is covered. So the static coordinate system has horizons, so we know that the space goes beyond our coordinate patch. This global system has no horizons, and so it covers the full spacetime. The other one that you will see is a so-called flat coordinatization. And this is, if you like, the cosmologically relevant one, because we suspect our universe is flat, and so we tend to write it as a product of some scale factor times a flat space. And if we describe the very early universe during a period of inflation, this would be what it would look like roughly. We have an exponential expansion. So we can represent the Sitter space as a surface in five dimensions, and that is this hyperboloid. So t squared minus u squared minus x squared minus y squared minus z squared would be equal to minus l squared in this case. So if we take the hyperboloid in five-dimensional space-time, we project down the metric that it inherits via this Gauss-Kadatze approach from flat space-time, we will get, actually, usually we get the global one, if we take the natural coordinatization of the three-sphere times the time-like direction.
Sorry, so in your drawing, which direction is which coordinate?
So this would be here is our t, and then this coordinate here, if I call this r, r squared is u squared plus x squared plus y squared plus z squared. So r is an s, this is an s3.
So we have a trisphere at every point?
Yes.
And
so, which is that?
The constraints mean that you live on the jar.
So this is representing, this is our four-dimensional universe, De Sitter space-time. So if we represent just De Sitter space-time in this way, the five-dimensional space is fictitious in a sense. It's there to give us a bit more of a geometrical insight to De Sitter space. But then actually there are ideas where we do literally say we live on a hypersurface in higher dimensions, in which case this would be physical. It would be extra dimensions to our four-dimensional space. But from the perspective of De Sitter space, this is just a way of achieving the metric on De Sitter space. It just happens to have a very simple embedding in 5D. So it's, it is. We actually saw this also with our domain wall, one stepping down a dimension where we were four-dimensional space. We actually sort of see then an example where we have a physical hypersurface on a hyperboloid. So what else did I want to say about De Sitter? Okay, if I want to... the Penrose diagram of De Sitter. So the Penrose diagram of De Sitter, we've got these horizons, we've got these causal horizons, so we have a sort of, a bit of a picture like that accelerating observer. The difference here is they're real, causal horizons in our space-time. We can't sort of get away from it. And so our Penrose diagram has to have these horizons, but we see that as in essence, because we've got this global picture here, what we've kind of done is sort of shrunk that down, as we shrunk down the black hole space-time, and we've sort of go from North Pole to South Pole of our S3.
Question.
Mm-hmm.
What is the NP and SP?
North Pole, South Pole. So it's like, these are just... if usually with Penrose diagrams, you're drawing them as two-dimensional diagrams. So there's always something going on in the other coordinate directions. So here, this is saying that I'm kind of ignoring two of the angles now on the three sphere. So I'm going like from theta is naught to theta is pi as I go across that diagram.
How can you relate the square to the jar? I don't see the
link. You know, it's not that straightforward. So if you looked at the flat coordinate system here, and you defined, instead of your cosmological coordinate, you defined a conformal time, which was e to the t on L, then you would be able to pull out that factor and you'd have flat space time. So that sort of gives you a clue as to when you compactify, it kind of looks a bit like, a sort of your t equals minus infinity kind of comes into a finite space. It's not obviously the same as Minkowski because you have the factor of e to the t, capital T, outside the metric. So as you go to infinity, you've also got this overall shrinking. I must admit, I'm just telling you this is the causal diagram. I'm not deriving it for you. But what it does satisfy is having causal horizons. So if you were sitting at the South Pole, your world line would be this. And so if you look at your asymptotic future, this has a boundary of this causal horizon, which is telling you you only sort of see half of the space-time. You can never see the North Pole. And that's the intuition of that is from the perspective of the expanding universe and the recession, there's always a limit to what you can see. And the further back in time you look, the further you get to see, but you can never see the other side of the universe, the sort of opposite pole, except in right at t equals infinity, you see the very beginning of the universe from the North Pole's perspective. That's kind of... So for a long time, we only ever looked at positive cosmological constant spacetimes. Lambda less than zero is called anti-de Sitter, or ADS, which of course now is considered to be an important spacetime because it has uses or applications in the context of string theory. So if we represent our metric in the form that we derived it, but instead of having two spheres, instead of having an SO3 symmetry, we just say we have a constant curvature spacetime. Because what happens in anti-de Sitter space is something rather interesting happens. So if kappa is 1, we've got d omega 2 squared. If kappa equals 0, we have just flat space, flat 2 r squared. If kappa is minus 1, we have a hyperboloid or a constant negative curvature space. So mathematicians would call this a Poincaré disk. And what's interesting about ADS from the perspective of black holes is that we have a solution for each of these. So in flat space or De Sitter space, we have to have a topologically spherical horizon. In anti-De Sitter space, we can have a flat horizon and a hyperbolic horizon. So this is now more interesting because we have a much more general class of solutions. The other thing that's different is because that R squared on L squared term is positive, we only have one horizon. So, and that, and then only if M is there. So we only have a black hole horizon. So if, for example, we had a planar black hole, that horizon would be at 2gm L squared to the 1/3. So the horizon radius is now some sort of mix between the black hole scale, the 2gm, and the anti-De Sitter scale, which is L. So the horizon radius is influenced by lambda, as is the temperature. So let's have a look at that. So so let's use our Euclidean method to find the temperature of the black hole. We have F d tau squared plus dr squared on F. And so our F looks like the we Taylor expand it near the horizon, we get the value of the derivative of F at the horizon times R minus R plus. We then define our rho coordinate, rho squared, so rho is basically taking the square root of r minus r plus up to a factor. So I see that 2 rho d rho is equal to 4 on f plus prime dr. I square that, and I see that rho squared d rho squared is 4 dr squared over f plus prime squared, which, if I substitute in the value of rho squared, tells me that d rho squared is dr squared over f plus primed r minus r plus. So that is our radial part of the metric. So I then look at the time part of the metric, and I want this to look like rho squared d chi squared with some angle, periodicity 2 pi. And so I deduce that the periodicity of tau, which is 1 over the temperature, is equal to 2 pi times 2 on f plus primed, which tells me that the temperature of my black hole is f plus primed over 4 pi. So here I haven't actually been, been specific as to whether I'm in de Sitter, anti-de Sitter, or in fact what I've got. All I've said is that if this is my metric local to the event horizon in the Euclidean section, this is the process I undergo to find out what the temperature is. So that's just quite a general relation. So just one thing to note, if we had Schwarzschild de Sitter, I could do this at each horizon, and I would actually get a different temperature. That's just one little piece of trivia, if you like. But I sort of want to think about ADS, but I guess I'm just thinking about cosmological constant more generally. So David has a nice tutorial prepared for you on thermodynamics of black holes in anti-de Sitter space. And you'll kind of look at this temperature and you'll sort of find some curious properties about it. So let me just think about a first law here. We've got, take the entropy. To be determined by the area of the event horizon. So what I want to do to sort of finish off, is to derive a first law of black hole thermodynamics with the cosmological constant. So we looked at a very naive first law just for Schwarzschild. So the strategy, our aim is to get a first law of thermodynamics, and the strategy is going to be to consider small variations in the location of the event horizon. So these small variations might occur if something is thrown into the black hole, for example. So our event horizon is defined as f of r plus equals zero. So we're going to consider variations in that relation. So my F, in general, has the form K. So remember, our F is, let's just take a spherical black hole so that I can do this in general. My F was a function that had a 2gm on R and a lambda R squared on 3. So small variations in the black hole horizon, this relation here, If the horizon radius changes, I'm going to get an F plus prime, delta R plus. If the mass changes, I get a 2g on R plus delta M. But let me just be completely, I know we say it's a constant, but let's just set that aside for the moment. Let's suppose that we vary lambda, then we would get this third term. I'm just being completely general and saying, what happens if I vary the expression for my horizon radius? So let me look. So this is equal to zero. Let me look at this. F plus primed, I just said, was related to t. So my F plus primed is 4 pi t. Then, what is my delta R plus? Well, if my entropy is pi R plus squared on G, I see that delta S is 2 pi R plus delta R plus on G. So delta R plus is going to be G delta S divided by 2 pi R plus. So I can cancel those 2 those pi's, and I see I've got 2g on r plus times t delta s. I've got a 2g on r plus times delta m. So let me pull out a factor of 2g on r plus in the last piece. So I want to have a 2g on r plus. So here I've got delta lambda on 3. So let me write this as delta, pull in the minus sign, delta of minus 8 pi g lambda, and then, no, lambda on 8 pi g, I apologize. Okay, so if I want a 2g on r plus, here's my g, I basically put a g in, I divide by g, I put 4 pi, 8 pi and a factor of 2, and there's my 3. So if I look at this, this looks like a volume. It would be the volume inside the horizon if it were flat space. And this sitting in here is just the pressure of, or the effective pressure due to the cosmological constant. So what I actually get if I rearrange this is that delta M is T delta S plus a V delta P, which is a first law, except interestingly, this M here looks more like the enthalpy rather than an internal energy. So normally you would have du was TdS minus PdV. But it's still a first law type of expression, but what's interesting about it is now we've allowed for lambda to vary. Now, usually people's first reaction when they saw this was to say, but hang on, it's a cosmological constant. Duh, it's constant, so it can't vary. However, when we deal with expanding universes in cosmology, we do it via inflationary theory, our cosmological constant is generated via the vacuum energy of a scalar field. So, and typically inflation isn't precisely constant lambda, it's usually a lambda that's slowly rolling. So I thought you should know, like this idea of this extended phase space of black hole thermodynamics, your tutor is one of the main sort of, initiators of this area. So he's written a lot of fundamental papers in the area. So you should take a look at that. And in fact, by thinking now of of the lambda varying, you can look at black holes in inflation, and you see that you can sort of find expressions for a slowly varying black hole space-time in slow roll inflation, and you find that this first law is sort of holds dynamically as well in real time. So that's sort of this is some sort of quite slightly different, you know, formal theoretical gravity, but this is kind of bringing you up to date with sort of what's going on in this area in the past few years. So, question?
So you keep on saying that it's a cosmological equation because it's impossible to solve Einstein equation if we allow lambda to vary on t, right?
So if you just try to put, so normally your cosmological constant is actually just a constant term from a gravitational action perspective. So you would have a, you know, add to the Einstein-Hilbert action, you would add a term that was the integral of root g d4x lambda over 8 pi g. So this, if you generate it this way, it's a constant. But remember, we had our scalar field as a half, you know, our Lagrangian looked like this. So this v is playing the role of a cosmological constant. So if v, for example, had a sort of a regime in which it was quite flat, nearly flat, your scalar field would be sort of rolling down this potential, but it would roll very slowly. And so your energy momentum tensor would look, so your energy momentum tensor, which is like a VGAB plus sort of a half phi dot squared, and that would be, I guess, I'm probably going to get this wrong. If I just, so you've also got the phi dot squared terms. Your rho is basically v plus a half phi dot squared, and your pressure is minus v plus a half phi dot squared. So if it's slowly rolling, it's dominated by the potential. So that looks like a cosmological constant, but it's not quite constant because you're generating it dynamically through a scalar field. If you don't do it that way, then you have to have a constant. But you can get something that fools you into thinking it's a lambda by generating it dynamically.